Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Paul O'Brien, Vice President for Policy and Advocacy with Oxfam America, who discusses Oxfam's recent report documenting the drivers of growing global wealth inequality. Robin Blakeman of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, who talks about the environmental and health hazards linked with the proposed Ohio River Appalachian Petrochemical Storage Hub, and investigative reporter and author Greg Palast, who examines the renewed threat of voter purges and suppression he sees in the decision to move President Trump's Election Integrity Commission to the Department of Homeland Security. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
United Nations peacekeepers are returning to a rebel-held area in South Sudan's war-torn Aqaba region to protect civilians from attacks by government troops. This comes as the government of South Sudan is facing increased pressure to observe a Christmas ceasefire, which had been quickly broken. This will be the first UN deployment in the region since 2013, when a UN camp was attacked and three Indian peacekeepers were killed. A total of 28 humanitarian aid workers were killed in South Sudan last year. The UN Children's Fund reports that since the civil war erupted 4 years ago, over 2 million children have been forced to flee their homes. More than 250,000 South Sudanese children now face severe malnutrition, and 19,000 youths fight as child soldiers in the conflict. UN peacekeepers are using a new nimble strategy, flying peacekeepers in a few days a week rather than setting up a permanent camp. Aid workers on the ground say they hope the extra security will help them expand distribution of humanitarian aid. In the early days of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, or CFPB, the agency launched an investigation into the World Finance Company, a subprime lender, for charging interest rates over 200% and trapping low-income customers into cycles of debt, enticing many to renew the loans over and over. The South Carolina-based company serves over 800,000 customers in the installment loan industry. But enforcement is no longer the mission of the Protection Bureau after President Trump appointed Mick Mulvaney to run the agency. Obama appointee Richard Cordray left the CFPB with a record of aggressive action against the abusive practices of credit card companies and payday lenders. In contrast, Mulvaney, a former South Carolina congressman, was a leading CFPB critic with ties to the World Finance Company. In 2014, Mulvaney complained the Protection Bureau was a joke and should be eliminated. ProPublica reports that under Mulvaney, who also runs the Office of Management and Budget, the Bureau is reconsidering its rule protecting consumers from deceptive payday loans and has dropped the number of enforcement actions. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, who helped launch the Bureau, complained CFPB should protect consumers, not giant companies. Dropping these cases, she wrote, is more evidence that Mulvaney is just using his time at CFPB to pay back the donors who funded his political career. In the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey, immigrant workers from El Salvador, Honduras, and Mexico came to Houston to find work in the cleanup of thousands of flood-damaged homes. Yet day laborers enjoy little job security and were vulnerable to working in unhealthy conditions, such as homes inundated with mold. Meanwhile, labor organizers have offered workshops to stop wage theft and provide health and safety training. Last November, a Houston Workers Center and the National Day Laborer Organizing Network released a survey of more than 350 day laborers. More than a quarter of those surveyed said that they were victims of wage theft. 85% said they hadn't received any health and safety training at their work sites, and more than a third reported having been injured on the job. Jose Garza, executive director of the Workers' Defense Project, told In These Times magazine, for years the industry has absolutely failed to prioritize safety. Garza says that worker empowerment can also be harnessed to push for longer-term changes. The real important process, he says, is helping working people to have agency and to build power. and then converting that power into meaningful policy change that ensures we don't have to face this situation every time a hurricane rolls through town. His organization is now working to pass living wage and workers' compensation legislation for construction workers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
A recently published report titled Billionaire Bonanza 2017, The Forbes 400 and the Rest of Us, exposed the extreme wealth concentrated within the fortunes of the 400 wealthiest Americans compared to the much more meager assets of working families. This is yet another piece of evidence confirming the decades-long trend of growing income inequality in the U.S. According to economists, that inequality will be greatly exacerbated by the new Republican tax reform legislation, which was recently signed into law by President Trump. As the world's wealthy elite gathered in Davos, Switzerland in mid-January for the annual World Economic Forum, the anti-poverty group Oxfam released its new report titled Reward Work, Not Wealth, which reveals how the global economy enables a wealthy elite to accumulate vast fortunes while hundreds of millions of people are struggling to survive on poverty pay. Among other disturbing data points, the report found that 82% of the wealth generated in 2017 went to the richest 1% of the global population, while the 3.7 billion people who make up the poorest half of the world saw no increase in their wealth. Your reporter spoke with Paul O'Brien, Vice President for Policy and Advocacy with Oxfam America, who summarizes some of the main findings in the Oxfam report, including the drivers of growing global wealth inequality and potential remedies.
We've been looking at structural inequality for about 5 or 6 years now and the extent of both extreme poverty and extreme wealth. And one of the things we've done each year as Davos has come together is to ask how many of the richest people on the planet does it take to have the same amount of wealth as the poorest half of the planet. This year, that number is 42 people. So the 42 richest people have the same wealth as the poorest half of the planet, which is 3.7 billion people. The thing that we found in our report this year that was most troubling to us is what had happened to the increase in wealth since the last time we did the report. Our analysis is that 82% of the wealth that was generated last year went to the top 1%, while the poorest half of the world, the people we care about, got basically nothing, no increase in wealth. That's the core finding.
I think there's a lot of superficial discussion about inequality here in the United States, and you always hear these neutral, quote-unquote neutral commentators talk about inequality as if it was an act of God or a natural disaster of some kind beyond human control. Obviously, that's not the case. So I wondered if you'd put in context for us the causes of this rising inequality.
Certainly. So from our perspective, we see inequality as a structural phenomenon that is the consequence of basically institutional failure. It's either the failure of governments to regulate corporations, or it's the acts of corporations to find ways to ensure they are the beneficiaries of under-regulation or bad regulation. We have a context now in the United States. Most people don't recognize how unequal the United States is, where the wealthiest 1% of Americans now own 40% of the country's wealth. That's the highest share that it's been in the last 50 years. President Trump likes to talk about the massive increase in wealth that has taken place in the American stock market. I heard him in Davos say that we now see there's an extra $7 trillion worth of wealth. In the United States, the wealthiest 10% owns 84% of stocks. The top 1% owns 40% of stocks. So what we have is an economic structure where it's getting harder and harder if what you do is just go to work every day and work hard, but you don't already own wealth or own stocks to lift yourself out of poverty. Whereas if you are already extremely wealthy, you don't have to do a lot in order to become wealthier still.
Your report, Reward Work Not Wealth, talks about some antidotes, and specifically Oxfam has called for certain policy changes at the governmental level, including changes in minimum wage policy, the gender pay gap, and fair taxation. Would you summarize some of those for us?
Well, those are very good to start with. There's going to be sort of three sets of responsibilities. We're going to need more effective and progressive taxation that targets wealth that is not working hard enough and then ultimately puts it in places where it could work much better. One of the ideas we're pushing, because we've seen this billionaire boom in the last year, and just to put a number on that, since the last time we did the report, there's been a new billionaire born every 48 hours. We estimate that if you put a tax on the wealth of billionaires of 1.5%, you could pay for every child to go to school everywhere in the world. So we would like to see a wealth tax taken seriously. This was put forward a few years ago by Piketty in his book Capital. There's been a robust discussion amongst economists on it. There's no good reason we can see why there is not a globally imposed wealth tax. We are also deeply concerned that public spending for both to strengthen opportunities for women generally, but in health and education, are underinvested in just about every country that we looked at, with very, very few exceptions. And then, as you mentioned, labor policies and making sure that people are protected in the workplace, are not discriminated at in the workplace, and are given the opportunity through hard work and innovation to lift themselves from poverty. For us, unfortunately, in many of the countries we work in, we're seeing things go in the other direction. So what we're seeing in many of the countries where we're working in is hardworking people doing their best to lift themselves out of poverty, but the policies on labor, on taxation, and on spending are not giving them the opportunities they need to lift themselves and their families out of poverty. And we want a more serious conversation about it, both amongst policymakers, amongst the wealthy, and amongst the kinds of people who are listening to your show.
That was Paul O'Brien, Vice President for Policy and Advocacy with Oxfam America. Find a link to Oxfam's Reward Work Not Wealth report and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For decades, dozens of petrochemical companies have built their plants along the Mississippi River in Louisiana, between Baton Rouge and the Gulf. These facilities are located right next to neighborhoods and belch out all kinds of toxic emissions. Not coincidentally, that strip is known as Cancer Alley, due to the higher rates of cancer among residents who live there. Now, gas and oil companies are promoting a plan to build a similar concentration of industrial plants along a stretch of the Ohio River, from its headwaters near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, south to Huntington, West Virginia, and beyond. Known as the Appalachian Storage Hub, federal lawmakers, especially in West Virginia, see the hub as a job bonanza. But many residents and activists don't want to be guinea pigs for a new potential Cancer Alley on the Ohio River. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Robin Blakeman, project coordinator with the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, or OVEC, which has taken the lead in educating residents and elected officials about the downside of the proposed project. Here, Blakeman discusses the environmental and health hazards linked to a future Appalachian petrochemical storage hub.
It seems to be an industrial attempt to grid up the Ohio River valleys with a bunch of petrochemical processing, storage, and transportation infrastructure. There are 5 to 7 cracker plants that have been discussed in this project. A cracker plant is a large facility that cracks the various components of natural gas apart in chemical processes, uses a lot of water, and can have a lot of air pollution implications to extract the parts of natural gas that would be useful in plastics and other commercial applications such as butane and propane and all that. It will be a massive complex that utilizes a lot of water from the river or other sources and also has a lot of air pollution implications and probably noise and discharges into the river and that kind of thing. The other major concern we have about the whole complex, I should have mentioned, is that it will allow for or actually encourage a second or third wave of gas fracking in our region from the Marcellus, the Utica, and the Rogersville field, which is a much deeper layer of shale gas and oil that has been recently tested and a few commercial wells have been built into it, but it's not commercially viable yet, but we think this complex will make it, you know, commercially viable.
Robin Blakeman, I know you don't have a lot of details, but can you tell us anything specific about the proposed storage hub?
Storage and transport pipelines that are part of this complex, there will be at least six, and we've heard there could be up to 15 liquefied natural gas product pipelines involved in this somehow, either coming in from various directions as connector lines or as the main part of this hub.
Well, this no doubt would be a lot of jobs, so isn't that a good thing?
Jobs are good, but we believe the potential environmental risk on a regional, local, and global scale actually is not worth it. The Ohio River is the tap water source for 3 to 5 million people, and so a major spill or several occurrences of leakages of this highly volatile and poisonous substance that will be in the salt caverns and the pipelines could be devastating.
I've heard references that this storage hub would be like Cancer Alley, where huge petrochemical plants line the Mississippi River from Baton Rouge to south of New Orleans, and where some cancers occur at a higher rate than in the population overall.
It's very similar in terms of both the products and the pollution. Of course, these would be newer plants, but that doesn't guarantee that they would be better plants and or storage lines. We have seen industry reports on this, news releases, et cetera, and some of those suggest that this hub, the Appalachian Storage Hub, is being built to provide an inland location for processing facilities and storage of liquefied natural gas products in order to provide more weather-resilient locations for such things. In other words, the way that we're interpreting that is that they are moving the locations of some of these facilities or want to move the locations of some of these facilities inland to the Ohio River Valley to avoid the effects of climate change on more coastal areas like the Gulf Coast.
And of course, it's this kind of fossil fuel development that is increasing the impacts of climate change. What are next steps in fighting the Appalachian Storage Hub?
We see the ASH or the Appalachian Storage Hub as the biggest threat we have heard of for a long time to, as I said, the tap water source for 3 to 5 million people, as well as a lot of people use the Ohio River for recreational purposes. It's a transport highway for barges, riverboats, and so it would be devastating to have the Ohio River damaged. The OVEC is based in Huntington, West Virginia, and Huntington has two water intakes. Both are on the Ohio River. So if something happens there, you know, our entire city will be without tap water. We are building a network of groups, as I said, from Beaver, Pennsylvania. We have allies up in that area, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area, in Ohio, Ohio Sierra Club. West Virginia Sierra Club is starting to look at it. We have built a coalition called the Appalachian Gas Working Group in West Virginia. And, you know, in addition to opposing this, we really want to be a proponent of renewable energy as well, solar, wind, some hydro projects, et cetera.
That was Robin Blakeman, project coordinator with the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. For more information on groups opposing the proposed Ohio River Petrochemical Hub, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Not long after Donald Trump won the presidential election through an Electoral College majority, he falsely claimed that he'd lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by some 3 million votes because millions of illegal votes were cast for the Democratic candidate. While Trump's accusation is baseless and has been repudiated by both Republican and Democratic state officials, the lie was a central rationale used to justify an executive order establishing the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. The commission was chaired by Vice President Mike Pence, and its vice chair, Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach, was well known as the architect of voter suppression laws adopted by GOP-controlled states across the U.S. After the commission failed to secure sensitive voter data from all 50 state governments and provoked 8 lawsuits for violating federal regulations, on January 3rd, President Trump disbanded the commission that in the end produced no evidence supporting his accusation of massive voter fraud. Ominously, Kris Kobach expressed satisfaction that the work of the now-defunct commission would be moved over to the Federal Department of Homeland Security, where department staff, he said, would search its files for immigrants, legal and otherwise, to detect foreign citizens who are illegally casting ballots in U.S. elections. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist Greg Palast, whose film documentary, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, examines Kobach's role in wrongly purging some 1.1 million Americans of color from the voter rolls in the 2016 election. Here, Palast discusses the renewed threat of voter purges and suppression he sees in moving the Kobach Commission to the Department of Homeland Security.
The Trump Commission, so-called Presidential Commission on Elections Integrity, is really, you know, what they call the Trump Fraud Commission, to prove that there's electoral fraud. You know, that literally Donald Trump and the guy put in charge of the commission, Kris Kobach of Kansas, can't remember that, just think KKK, Kris Kobach of Kansas, the Secretary of State there, has claimed that 1 million people swam the Rio Grande, I kid you not, to vote for Hillary. And in addition, 3 million people voted twice. Now, the mainstream media laughed at this charge, and you know, as far as they were concerned, the commission was a laugh. I'm not laughing as an investigative reporter because I've been following this Kobach well before the commission now for since 2013 on his trail the last 5 years, knowing that he was working with Trump. He was the first politician, major elected official to endorse Trump, and with other right-wing groups and funded by the Kochs. Remember, he's out of there, Bailiwick, Wichita, Kansas. And to come up with systems to remove voters. So you may laugh and say, ha ha, there's no people swimming the Rio Grande to vote for Hillary, except they're removing people with Hispanic surnames. And that's what they really wanted to do with this commission. That's the first order of business. So Kobach met on January 10th privately with Donald Trump to say, here's what you got to do. You got to run the system of removing Hispanic voters from the voter rolls by using the powers of Homeland Security. And we can all do it in secret. Trump decided instead with Pence, let's have a public commission. Well, they immediately started operating in secret. They wouldn't even tell the Democrat when the meetings were, what's on the agenda, what are they doing. And when you have a presidential commission, guess what? We have a government of and by and for the people. We have freedom of information. You've got to reveal what you're doing and who you're doing it to. They wouldn't. They got scared. Kobach recommended shutting down the commission. And a lot of progressives said that's a big victory. In some ways it is, because we forced them to close that commission. The problem was they took their nefarious activities and they stuck them into the Department of Homeland Security, where they can put the shroud of national security over their doings. I don't know if it'll be successful, by the way. You can't just mark something national security, just say when you're removing black and Hispanic voters from the voter rolls and say that's part of the war on terror. And, you know, it depends if we have some honest judges, they're going to crack that open. The problem is the mainstream media has been laughing about Kobach and his claims, laughing about Trump and his claims of voter fraud. If you watch my film, you'll laugh because I do a lot of dark humor in there, but you won't laugh about what they're doing. They did remove, ready, 1.1 million voters of color from the voter rolls before the 2016 election. That absolutely handed them Michigan, had a great deal to do with handing them Ohio, North Carolina, Arizona. These were states that were in Kobach's purge programs. And so what you get in the film is the investigation about this commission in Kobach well before the commission starts. In fact, I even jumped Chris Kobach at an ice cream social in Wichita.
Greg, what is, in your opinion, the biggest threat to the integrity of the vote in 2018 that a lot of people who are opposed to Trump and the Republican agenda are hoping will turn things around in Congress? The House of Representatives may be flipped, as some polls predict, and maybe even the Senate.
Well, what we've seen is that the polls, including the exit polls, we have something called a redshift, where the numbers come out different than the polls. How does that happen? The answer is that funny term, vote suppression. And my biggest fear, I know a lot of people are afraid of, you know, electronic voting machines and stuff. I'm not saying don't worry about it. You got a lot of things to keep track of, to worry about. But the one thing we're not spending enough time on and thought on and action on is the prevention of Americans of color from voting. And students, by the way, that's also another target group that they go after. Students and voters of color. And basically, when they go after voters of color, it means going after poor voters. Like things like, we all are familiar with these laws about ID. Well, who doesn't have a driver's license? Guess what? People who don't drive, people who don't have cars. It tends to be poor Americans or students. Again, demographic. The others, who is accused of voting twice? People with simply common names like Jose Garcia. Again, Democratic demographics. I'm not here to support the Democratic Party. I'm here to support counting every vote and letting Americans vote. You know, the rest of the world is stunned at everything that we do to block voters. We think it's okay if you get away with it. That's what I'm concerned with.
That was investigative reporter and author Greg Palast, whose film documentary is titled The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Case of the Stolen Election. Find links to Palast's film, investigations, and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.